Please be seated. Please be seated. We are here in the matter of Taxpayers for the Protection of Nevada Jobs versus Arena Initiative. This is case number 57157. Are counsel prepared to proceed?
Yes,
very well. On behalf of the appellant.
Thank you and good morning. May it please the court, for the record, I'm Scott Sheriff, Holloman Hart, LLP, appearing on behalf of Taxpayers for the Protection of Nevada Jobs. With me this morning is my partner, Rick Elmore. I'd like to reserve 5 minutes of my time for rebuttal. This case involves two separate challenges by taxpayers to the initiative petition called Building an Arena for a Stronger Future, filed by the Arena Initiative Committee. The first challenge was filed shortly after the filing of the initiative and asserted that the initiative violates the single subject rule, dictates administrative details, and contains a deficient description of effect. Despite expressing reservations about the description of effect, the district court upheld the initiative and allowed the committee to proceed with collecting signatures. The Secretary of State, based upon the random sampling performed by the county clerks, determined that the initiative had sufficient signatures to qualify for the ballot. Taxpayers then challenged the initiative, alleging numerous violations of the applicable statutory and constitutional requirements applicable to initiatives. In particular, taxpayers alleged that the committee and its circulators, taking advantage of the misleading and deceptive description of effect, used fraudulent claims to convince voters to sign the petition, filed false affidavits because they failed to personally circulate petitions as required by NRS 295.0575, and improperly altered the required affidavits attached to petitions. The district court disqualified the signatures of certain circulators who expressly admitted that they circulated petitions in teams, but determined there were still sufficient signatures to qualify the initiative for the ballot. Taxpayers filed timely appeals of each of the district court's decisions, and the cases were consolidated. Turning first to the description of effect. The description of effect misleads voters both with affirmative misrepresentations and with material omissions. For example, the description claims that there is, quote, no preferred usage to those involved in its development slash maintenance, close quote. Yet the language of the initiative does not prohibit preferred usage for those involved in the maintenance of the arena. Under the actual language of the initiative, Harrah's could conceivably create a new company that would operate and maintain the arena and in return receive preferred usage. Yet the description of effect misleads voters into believing otherwise. But the real deception in the description is the description's material omission. It does not give the public any notice of the fact that the actual effects of the initiative's requirements for a qualifying arena eliminate all of the competing arena proposals except the proposal favored by the committee.
Let me just ask the question. What about this court doing some judicial surgery, as they say, and fixing it up so that other entities could qualify, such as removing the 96,000 rooms?
If the committee had submitted an initiative that merely said they wanted to raise the sales tax to allow to construct an arena, we wouldn't be arguing about the single subject rule. We wouldn't be arguing about administrative details. Don't know about the description of effect, since that would depend upon the specifics of that description of effect. But certainly that's one option that is open to the court, is to sever those offending provisions.
And go ahead and tell us exactly what you would sever if you were sitting where I'm sitting.
Well, frankly, if I'm sitting where you were sitting, I would strike the entire initiative.
I think it's, well, Scott, you're not, so.
However, it's not just the 95,000 rooms. It's the restriction that does not allow it to be in the city, that it restricts it only to unincorporated areas, so you can't have the downtown Las Vegas arena proposal is eliminated. The land has to be donated, which Harrah's has agreed to do. But, part of the argument at the district court was, well, you could have some other parcel within this narrow area of land that might qualify. Sure, the Wynn golf course might qualify. You could build it there. But is Wynn going to give up its golf course, donate its golf course for the building of an arena? It's not likely to happen. The fact, and there's been no suggestion that they're willing to do that. The only arena proposals that have actually been suggested are all eliminated by this language.
But you'd have no objection to a special tax district in order to have an arena which would draw in maybe NHL team or an NBA team?
Well, we believe that a special tax district is inappropriate in that if it's less than the entire county or less than the entire incorporated city. But I think that's another issue. We certainly do believe that it is a policy matter and appropriate for an initiative.
I know we'll have competing, if this is allowed, competing ballot initiatives, because the legislature says only one sales tax per county versus this, which would have a special sales tax district.
Correct. And all of that has also been challenged by the committee in a separate district court case. It is important to bear in mind with regard to the description of effect that it requires a description of effect. It's not a legal description that's required by the statute. Rather, it is a description of what the initiative will actually do if it's passed by the voters. In Las Vegas Taxpayer Accountability Committee versus City of Las Vegas, this court looked at what the consequences of the referendum would be and struck that referendum because of its consequences, not because of any specific language in that referendum itself. So this court has made it clear that it will look beyond the language to the actual effects of an initiative or referendum in determining whether the description of effect is accurate. The effect of this initiative, as we discussed, is to exclude not just one, but all of the competing arena proposals. I mentioned the downtown Las Vegas proposal. There's a proposal for an arena on the old Wet n' Wild site, which is along the Las Vegas Strip, right across from the convention center. It is excluded by this language. And also once on the south end of town, down in the area toward the M Resort, right off of I-15, that's also excluded by the language in the initiative. Even the new proposal for an arena on the UNLV campus would be excluded under the language of this initiative. So, and then despite their protestations to the contrary, the committee has never denied that all of these competing arena sites are excluded by its language or been able to point to any proposal to build an arena that would qualify other than their own under the language of the initiative. The description of effect and single subject rules are closely related. Both are designed to ensure that the public has adequate notice of what an initiative will do and the interests that are likely to be affected by that initiative. The purpose of the committee's initiative, according to its own purpose clause, is, quote, to provide by statute for the imposition of an additional sales and use tax for the manner in which the proceeds of that tax must be used for the construction, acquisition, improvement, equipment, operation, and maintenance of such arenas, plural. Nothing in the purpose clause says anything about eliminating competing arena sites. Only through careful study and analysis of the initiative's criteria for a qualifying arena does this become apparent. The initiative simply does not give the public notice of the interests likely to be affected by the initiative as required by Nevada's single subject rule.
Do you have an argument about what would happen with Thomas and Mack if they lose the rodeo to this new entity, or South Point with its arena and Orleans with its arena? Does that have any effect that we have three arenas, at least now, existing right now?
I don't know that it has any effect on this particular case and this particular initiative. No, but certainly those are economic consequences that both the state and the county ought to be able to weigh. And that's part of our concern with the administrative details portion of our argument, is that by dictating that it has to be in this particular site, it takes away the judgment of the county commission in deciding what's the most appropriate site for a new arena. A new taxpayer-funded arena. We understand that the proponents of this initiative did not want to just have a sales tax proposed to fund any arena that the county might choose or allow the county to go through that process. They don't want to spend the time, energy, and money on the initiative process and have the county then choose a different arena proposal. So their concern is understandable, but it's not policy. It's a crass attempt to dictate administrative details by requiring the county commission to approve their particular arena proposal. Now, turning to some of the issues in the second case, the burden of proof is a key issue in that second case. In Fabeck versus Beck, the Supreme Court of Colorado was confronted with a Colorado statute that specifically placed the burden of proof on the challengers of an initiative. Once the challengers produced evidence of discrepancies in the petition, however, the Colorado Supreme Court ruled that the burden shifted to the proponents of the initiative to demonstrate substantial compliance. This is the precise holding for which Fabeck was cited by this court in LVCBA versus Miller, and it is the only holding that makes sense in the context of these cases. What would this court have done in LVCBA if the proponents of the initiatives in that case had written in the missing statements into the affidavits? Would it have required, would it have said that the burden was on the challengers to prove that those written-in statements were not in there at the time that the circulators executed the affidavits? Or would it have pointed to those discrepancies, the fact that they'd handwritten in these additional statements, and shifted the burden to LVCBA, or, and shifted the burden to the proponents of the initiatives in that case to show, in fact, that they had substantially complied with the requirements of the law? In this case, taxpayers met its initial burden by showing discrepancies in the documents and the process by which the documents were circulated. The burden then shifted to the committee to demonstrate substantial compliance. In arguing that there's no remedy for fraud in the circulation process, the committee cites the numerous statutes and regulations governing the initiative petition process, including the requirement for the description of effect in circulators' affidavits. Only by requiring, however, clear and meaningful standards and a clear and meaningful description of effect can those statutory and constitutional requirements be a meaningful safeguard to prevent fraud in the administrative process. There's a tendency in cases like this to say, let it go to the voters. What's the harm? Let the voters decide. Let me tell you the harm. The proponents of this initiative will spend millions of dollars to get this initiative enacted because it's going to save them hundreds of millions of dollars. So it's worth it to them. Without a campaign run to counter that, we run the risk that of a very bad initiative becoming law. We've seen that over and over again in California. In a presidential election year, it's going to be difficult to find advertising time. It's going to be expensive to do it, and it's going to be difficult to find time on a crowded ballot. So the state is also going to be impacted by having this initiative on the ballot as well. There are reasons that there are rules for ballot access, and it's important that we follow those rules. And with that, I'd like to reserve the rest of my time.
Thank you, Mr. Scheer.
Thank you very much.
Mr. Woodbury, it's my understanding that you're going to be sharing your time with Mr. Benson. Is that correct?
That's correct.
Very well. So that I can help you to keep track of that, what is the time that you've allotted for yourself?
4 minutes will be reserved for Mr. Benson.
Oh, very well.
Madam Chief Justice, Honorable Justices of the Nevada Supreme Court, Counsel, and may it please the Court. My name is Jason Woodbury. I'm with Kempfer Kroll. With me today is my partner, Severin Carlson, and we represent the ARENA Initiative Committee. Mr. Scheer made a reference to a general tendency on the part of this Court and judicial policy to let matters go to the voters and allow the voters to decide. I submit to this Court that it is much more than a general tendency. In Nevadans for the Protection of Property Rights, this Court established its touchstone for pre-election initiative review, saying, quote, strong public policy favors upholding the initiative power whenever possible. There is certainly no shortage in the number of allegations made by the appellant against the ARENA initiative in this case. But while the quantity of those challenges is substantial, their quality is not. Let me address first the challenger's position regarding the initiative's description of effect. This Court has addressed the legal standards applicable to such descriptions in many previous cases. Broadly speaking, the description must be straightforward, succinct, and non-argumentative. Narrowing that a bit, the description cannot be deceitful or misleading. But the most important thing that this Court has recognized in its previous cases is that there is never a single right answer for a description. If we were to take the ARENA initiative and give it to 100 people, we would get back 100 different descriptions. Some might be sufficient. Maybe many would be sufficient, but none would be insufficient because it was different than any of the other proposals. The ARENA initiative description satisfies the standards established by NRS 295009 and this Court's interpretation of that statute. In fact, I submit that it goes beyond those standards and is as accurate as it can reasonably be given the 200-word limitation. Nevertheless, the appellant claims that the description is defective for three reasons. All three are rebutted in our brief, but let me address the two that appear to be appellant's primary argument. The first is what Mr. Scheer contends, or contended here in his argument. Their contention is that the description of effect must include a statement that only one location is eligible for the arena to be located on at that location. The description doesn't include that, and there's a reason that it doesn't include that. It's not true. The appellant is trying to push this case into a universe where there are only four possible arenas, the four that were proposed before the Clark County Commission in the summer of 2010.
That population of four, how many would it exclude?
Of those four that were previously presented, it would exclude the three. There's no dispute about that. But the terms of the arena initiative encompass 1,700 acres of property which could satisfy the criteria of the initiative.
Well, what about the argument then that the county commission then loses its authority to select the arena site?
It certainly does not, Justice Sherry.
Tell us why.
It doesn't, because the arena initiative establishes criteria, those criteria that it has to be within 2 miles of 95,000 transient rooms, and the other criteria. But when it, as long as any proposal satisfies those criteria, it is eligible under the arena initiative. And not only does it not compel a decision by the county commission, what the initiative says is that if there are multiple proposals that meet that criteria, the county commission decides which one, and the only limitation on the county commission's discretion in that regard is that it has to pick the best one in the interests of the county. So it is simply not accurate to say that because three previous arena proposals would be excluded under this criteria, that means that the only one that's left standing is the other proposal. In fact, there's no dispute in the record that over 1,700 acres of property would be eligible under this criteria.
But then you'd also need a good Samaritan that's willing to donate the property.
Well, that's part of the policy. And a lot of what Mr. Scheer talked about in his argument was policy. And whether or not the arena initiative is good policy, bad policy, or somewhere in between is not before this court. The fact of the matter is that one of the purpose of the arena initiative is not just to establish a funding mechanism, not just to establish an arena, but to establish a public-private partnership. Now, the funding mechanism is a tax. That's the public part of the public-private partnership. So if there's going to be a tax imposed for the construction of the arena, for the maintenance of the arena, one has to ask, well, where does the private part of this come in? And there may be other ways to do it, but the policy choice that the initiative proponents made was to say, here's where the private part comes in. The private part is going to be a donation or somehow a contribution of that property that is not funded by the arena tax. Now, there could be other ways, many other ways to satisfy that, but that's the policy choice that the initiative proponents made.
Counsel, I'm sorry, had you finished your thought to Justice Perry?
Yes, Justice Hartz.
I wanted to interject my question here because you referenced the arena tax. This court has, on at least 9, maybe 11 occasions, considered a constitutional issue sua sponte. As I understand the initiative, the tax which is proposed in this case would be a slight increase to sales and use taxes that occur within a 3-mile distance from the qualifying arena. Is that right?
And further, any unincorporated area within that distance.
Could you tell me, if you're in a position to respond, whether such a tax provision violates this court's decision in Clean Water Coalition versus the M Resort, published last May, in which the court interpreted the provisions of Article 4, Section 20 and 21 of the Nevada Constitution?
In the sense of the issue being whether or not it's a special law versus a general law?
That's right.
Okay. I am in somewhat of a position to address that, but if that is truly an issue that the court is going to consider and is important to the disposition of this case, I would ask for a specific opportunity to address that in some form of supplementary briefing, because it is an important issue, and it is an issue to be addressed. Our position on that would be that this satisfies the criteria of a general law because of the fact that it includes a population trigger, which this court...
I'm sorry, it includes a, oh, a population.
Population trigger, which this court has recognized. A law can be of general application even though it only operates in a particular locality if it is triggered by a population trigger. So our position on that would be that it does not run afoul of the Clean Water Coalition case because of the fact that it includes that population trigger. And although, let's be clear, obviously the population trigger is 800,000. There's only one county in Nevada under the current circumstances that actually applies to. There is certainly no knowing whether or not in the future that law would be triggered by another.
I appreciate you haven't had an opportunity to consider this for purposes of supplemental briefing, and maybe it is worthwhile to do if my colleagues agree. But that said, in the context of taxation provisions, is the population trigger provision itself unconstitutional?
No, I don't believe that it is, Your Honor. I'm really not in a position to elaborate on that at this point in time. But we certainly, I can assure you, took into account the requirements and parameters of general law versus special law in drafting the initiative.
Could you comment on counsel's argument that description of effect should include unstated consequences, and whether this description of effect violates or does not violate that principle?
I think that is a very dangerous road to go down. The purpose of the description of effect is to encapsulate the initiative. Now, we may have all sorts of ideas and disagreements about, okay, let's assume it's in place under existing circumstances, what is the effect of that? And I'll give you an example from their brief. They say that one of the reasons our description is deficient is because we don't specifically and comprehensively define the term gaming enterprise district. Well, the term gaming enterprise district is included in the description, and the reason it's not feasible to expand beyond that, one of the reasons is it can change. The parameters of the gaming enterprise district could be changed during the circulation process, after the circulation process. So if we describe what it is today, and maybe a bunch of people sign it, before the election it may change. So our description becomes necessarily deceitful because we've identified an area that is no longer an area of the gaming enterprise district.
Would the county commission, under your proposal here, have the authority to define that term?
To define gaming enterprise district?
Mm-hmm.
They do have authority. It is defined in NRS, I believe it's 463, and I don't know the exact site, but it is defined as any area that has been designated by a county as appropriate for non-restricted grant gaming. Now, that ability of the county commission is not unlimited because there are grandfathered locations.
Right.
But to the extent going forward in a prospective sense, yes, the county
commission. So under existing law, the county can resort to a definitional of that term.
That's correct, Your Honor.
Mm-hmm. And it, through that vehicle, can designate these other arena sites.
You're correct.
Counsel, before you sit down, an issue that may be problematic, but I'd like to hear your take on it, the 95,000 rooms of transient lodging, being very specific in its effect because of the Clean Water Coalition case. How does that impact? Should we just throw everything out because of this?
I don't believe it does impact anything, Your Honor, because the 95,000 room provision is, again, a policy choice. The arena, the overall policy is that the arena would attract tourists and tourist dollars.
I understand that, but as we look at it, and look at it as to statewide application, are we being very realistic and taking off the blinders looking at that number?
Well, there are obviously, I mean, the reality is that there are extremely limited locations that would satisfy that criteria, and I certainly wouldn't know of any outside of Clark County. But it's a policy choice. You could make the number 10,000. You could make it 100,000. The policy choice, which the initiative proponents made, was 95,000 rooms. And it's rationally related. There's a rational basis for why that's connected to the funding mechanism, why it's connected to the purpose of the arena.
In terms of our jurisprudence, does it become too surgical in its application? I mean, because it takes out other parts of the county as well.
It doesn't, Your Honor, because the overall purpose of overall theme of the jurisprudence is that on these policy choices such as this, it's up to the electorate to decide. And certainly that can be part of the campaign against the arena initiative. That can be part of the argument, the ballot arguments that are drafted against the arena initiative, is this is too specific, this is too surgical. But at the end of the day, it's up to the 2012 general election electorate.
When you take that into consideration with the population ability in Nevada to be population specific as to allowing certain in and certain out, are we on the threshold of throwing out that population release, so to speak, of allowing specialty laws that aren't applicable in other parts of the state?
Well, I don't mean to, in my response to Justice Hardesty, I don't mean to discount and say, hey, if you've got a population trigger, that's the end of the question on the general special law distinction. It has to be a legitimate and real exercise of that. I think clearly the arena initiative is.
Mr. Woodbury, I assume that you are aware that you've burned through your co-counsel's time. I'm going to give him a little bit of time, but I assume also that you are not going to concede single subject. Is that something that Mr. Benson is going to address?
No. Given the time factor, I would have to defer to our brief. We have made every effort to comprehensively address
that. Very well. Mr. Benson, you can have 3 minutes.
Thank you, Madam Chief Justice. May it please the Court, my name is Kevin Benson, Deputy Attorney General, on behalf of Respondent Ross Miller, Secretary of State. My client does not have any interest in the merits of this particular initiative. Our only interest are in the questions of law that are likely to recur in initiative petition litigation in the future. Of course, chief among those is the question of which party bears the burden of proof. Mr. Scheer mentioned that the Fabeck case merely requires that the protester, the opponent, demonstrate there have been some discrepancies. I don't believe that's what that case holds. What they required in that case is that the protesters demonstrate or that they justify their protest. In that case, Colorado law required that the circulator execute the affidavit in front of a notary. The particular issue there was either the date of the notary's signature and the date of the circulator's signature did not match, or one of them had been altered. That's a type of alteration that on its face raises doubts about whether or not it was in fact executed in front of a notary. So that type of alteration does raise doubts on its face and may be justified. It wasn't merely raising some discrepancies, because the fact of the matter is we're talking about a statewide initiative that involves hundreds of thousands of signatures. Some errors are going to occur. That is the reason we have the verification process that the clerks go through in the first place. And what that process is designed to do is to go through the signatures, go through the petition documents, and to check to see whether, in spite of those errors that will inevitably occur, there are still sufficient valid signatures to go on the ballot. That's what the clerks did in this case. And after compiling all those results, the secretary determined that the petition in this case was sufficient. As the party trying to overturn that determination, the plaintiffs correctly were given the burden of proof in this case. The simple matter is that they failed to carry that burden of proof. And we have two general standards that come up in initiative petitions. One of them is strict compliance with constitutional requirements, and the other is substantial compliance with statutory and regulatory requirements. Where strict compliance is necessary, the plaintiffs must show that there are errors and that they are sufficient in number to invalidate the petition. Where substantial compliance is the correct standard, the plaintiffs must show not only are there sufficient numbers to invalidate the petition, but also that the errors are substantial enough to cause the purpose of the law to no longer be carried out. In other words, that the document at issue no longer substantially complies with the law. In this case, they raised numerous allegations that there were alterations to the affidavit, for example. However, what we don't know is what those alterations were. We don't know if it was, I changed my zip code from 89701, crossed out 89703, for example. We simply don't know from the face of these documents that what those errors were and that they did not substantially comply. And therefore, they failed to meet the burden of proof of even justifying their protest in this case.
Thank you, Mr. Benson.
Can I ask Mr. Benson a question?
Of course.
So, Mr. Benson, you don't object or contest that a burden shift occurs in this jurisprudence. It's that the burden shift, when the burden shift occurs, may be different depending on the subject matter.
I don't think it's accurately described as a burden shifting analysis. I think this is an ordinary civil case, and like any other civil case, the plaintiff bears a burden of proof by a preponderance of the evidence. They can present some evidence that there are material alterations that would invalidate an affidavit and it should have been thrown out. If the proponents of the initiative have some evidence to rebut that, then they're certainly free to present that. But the plaintiffs initially must bear that burden of showing that that affidavit is, in fact, invalid.
But in the context of whether something is constitutional or not, which has usually been a significant demarcation line for our jurisprudence in evaluating pre-voting review, pre-petition review, that burden would exist always on the opponent, always on the petitioner.
Not sure.
To show that it's unconstitutional.
I'm sorry, to show that what is unconstitutional?
That the initiative petition is unconstitutional. The proposed initiative is unconstitutional.
If I understand your question correctly, you're referring to the subject matter of the initiative as being unconstitutional.
Right.
And my recollection is that usually that is reserved for a post-election challenge rather than a pre-election challenge because, of course, if the voters reject it at the polls, then it is a non-issue.
Right. So the question that I posed about whether Article 4, Section 20 or 21 might impact this is something that should be deferred to see whether it passes or not.
In that particular case, my client has no interest in that particular question, but I understand that it has been challenged in the district court and is currently going through that process now. So I expect that you will see it sooner or later.
So that issue has been presented in the district court on this petition?
I don't recall exactly if that's one of the exact issues raised in this case or if that is something that is going to be reserved until after the election, but I do believe that it has been at least addressed partially, if not exactly head-on in the district court.
Mm-hmm. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Benson. Mr. Scheer.
Thank you, Madam Chief Justice. Mr. Woodbury cites the property rights case and the general statement of with regard to how initiatives should be treated, but it's important to bear in mind in that case this court still struck several provisions of that initiative. So despite stating that there is a general standard to allow initiatives to go forward, this court still looks at whether the requirements for those initiatives have in fact been met. Did that also in the taxpayer accountability case, the recent case involving the city of Las Vegas. And again, struck that referendum and struck the initiative from the ballot, both for violations of the single subject rule and for violations of the description of effect rule. There are only, Mr. Woodbury also says that there are only four possible arenas, that we've narrowed that. There were four that had been submitted prior to the time of the initiative. There have been other arena proposals since then, but they can't point to any of those arena proposals that would, in fact, qualify. There was another one that was considered during the legislative session. It didn't qualify. It didn't meet all of these criteria. I mentioned the UNLV arena earlier. It doesn't meet all of these criteria. Justice Hardesty asked about the county redefining gaming enterprise district. Yes, they could do that, but they still wouldn't meet the requirements for being in the unincorporated area. The city, the downtown Las Vegas arena site would still be eliminated. They still wouldn't meet the requirements for the 95,000 hotel rooms within a two-mile radius. So they wouldn't meet the requirements for donating the property. You've got to remember, in looking at this 1,700-acre area, which their own witness provided an affidavit in the district court, said that it's basically between Tropicana and DI, Paradise and I-15. We're talking about the most expensive real estate in the valley. And we're talking about the most densely packed real estate in the valley. To find a site for an arena and all the parking that would go with an arena would be extremely difficult in that area unless somebody is willing to actually implode a hotel. Yes, it can be done. Yes, it's theoretically possible, but it's not realistic. We submitted our own proposed description. Mr. Woodbury says it's impossible to do within 200 words. We submitted one to the district court that it would have been satisfactory. Turning to Mr. Benson's arguments, there is no evidence that the clerks or the secretary considered discrepancies in the affidavits or that the false affidavits were filed in doing their verification. They don't do that. They look at, is this person a registered voter? Is the address correct? Does the signature match? They don't look at, are the affidavits altered? Are the affidavits false because they weren't personally circulated? And in fact, in the secretary's brief, the secretary concedes that the district court was correct in striking some of the signatures because they were not, the documents were not personally circulated. I want to look, too, in terms of meeting our burden to shift the burden. The committee helped us meet that burden. They submitted an affidavit in response to all the evidence we provided, all the documents, all the petition documents, which are as a public record, but we nevertheless provided documents on CDs from multiple counties, and multiple examples were attached to our opening brief. But in the affidavit that they used to respond to our opening brief, in paragraph 14, the committee's affidavit asserts, quote, circulators in general and Mr. Saunders and Ms. Oravivo often work in teams rather than alone. In paragraph 15, the committee asserts, quote, sometimes circulation teams will include multiple circulators working together or a circulator working with another person who is not a designated circulator, meaning the person who will not execute a circulator's affidavit, close quote. So they told us that they were engaged in team circulating in response to our allegations. They admitted it. Mr. Elmore, in depositions, asked the three witnesses that the committee had whether they agreed that those statements were true, and they all confirmed that those statements are, in fact, true. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Benson, Mr. Woodbury, thank you all for your arguments here today. This matter will stand submitted.